We're spending the hour on placebos here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. A placebo is administered like a drug. We may think sugar pill. It's a fake drug with no medical benefit. And so the placebo effect refers to a non-medicated reaction, which has really long fascinated the scientific community. But it leaves us wondering, is this pill working? Is it all in my head? The idea of the placebo effect having actual medical benefits is one that researchers are grappling with right now. Have you been part of a clinical trial? Have you taken a placebo? What did it do for you? What questions do you have about medical conditions that may have promised to be treated with placebos? We're at 800-642-1234. Catherine Hall is a molecular biologist. She is an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and directs the placebo genetics program as part of Harvard's placebo studies based at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So the simple act of taking a pill seems to do wonders for the brain. What is going on?
That's exactly what we're trying to figure out. We have some clues, mostly from neuroimaging and from pharmacology. From neuroimaging studies, what we see is that there are specific areas of the brain that light up when people take a placebo pill or have a placebo intervention. And also, we see that those areas are associated with signaling through neurons that use dopamine and use opioids. And so in studies where they've inhibited opioid signaling, we've seen that that can block a placebo response. So those scientific experiments give us clues that what is happening through basically our brain.
So there are chemicals in the brain that may impact whether we have a placebo response or not.
That's what we're learning, yes.
For a long time in clinical drug trials, when placebos were effective, it meant the drug was considered a failure. Why did scientists assume a drug must not be working if a fake pill had the same effects?
Well, it's not that the drug is not working. What we want to see is that you can get more benefit from the drug than you can get from taking a sugar pill. And that's to get at, is this drug working? Is it using its mechanism of action to improve the underlying pathology? And the way to tell that is to basically compare the effect of the drug to the effect of a placebo. So it's not necessarily that we assume that the drug wasn't working. We just have to demonstrate that it's working beyond the effect of a placebo.
Where did placebos come from? When did the medical community start using them?
That's a great question. And you can see the origins of placebos, well, in terms of treating patients, from as far back as, you know, the Egyptians and their medicines. People have been treating people with whatever remedy they can generate, whether it's, you know, ground up tree bark, which actually turns out to not be a placebo in the case of willow bark, it's aspirin. But treating patients with something to help them get better. And sometimes the thing that they were using had a biological effect, had a pharmacological effect, but sometimes it really had no effect that beyond the action of giving somebody the treatment. And this has been, you know, basically from the dawn of time, before we had the pharmaceutical company to really study the mechanism of action of drugs and design drugs to treat specific pathologies. So you can see placebos developing throughout time, and the word placebo really only comes into use in the 1930s, the mid to late 1930s, when physicians realized that, yes, these bread peels, this salt water, this colored tincture, they know it doesn't have an effect, but they have nothing else to give a patient. And it's okay to do so, to give a patient something that is inert before World War II.
We're talking with Catherine Hall, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, director of placebo genetics at their program in placebo studies. You can join in. Have you taken part in clinical trials? Do you know if you received a placebo or the real drug? Was it a double-blind study, or were you informed that you were getting the placebo or the real drug? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Catherine, up to like the 1930s, you're saying that, you know, placebos were used because maybe medicine hadn't caught up and physicians were trying anything that they might think to try. When do we actually start seeing placebos incorporated into clinical studies?
After World War II, when there was a need for more and more clinical trials to demonstrate efficacy of drugs, and there was a need for more drugs, we start to see placebos being introduced into clinical trials as controls. And ever since then, they've become an integral part of clinical trials, and they're the gold standard for demonstrating efficacy. Basically, a drug has to beat the placebo in randomized clinical trials now.
And when you say double-blind studies, explain where the physician comes in and what the patient knows.
So informed consent is a really important ethical tenet in clinical trials. The patient should know what they're taking and what the known effects of the treatment that they're taking are. So the reason why we've introduced double blinding is because of bias. And certainly if you believe in a treatment as a physician, you might have more of a tendency to assume that something that the patient said was indicative that they had some benefit. And you might interpret a patient's symptoms positively if you have a bias towards a drug. And so they wanted to blind not only the physician who might have this bias, but also the patient that might have a bias that, oh, I'm taking an active drug. This drug is going to help me. I'm not experiencing my headache today. It must be the drug. This is really working. So by introducing double blinding, both the patient and the clinician are blinded to what they're taking, but they're told that they might be given a drug or a placebo.
Does that help elevate the efficacy of placebos, that because we have a double blind study that you can really understand if there is a placebo effect that is working?
Well, that's an interesting question. And there are studies on what we call randomization ratios. So what is your chance of getting an active treatment versus getting a placebo? And what they've seen is that having a 75% chance of getting active drug tends to be more effective than having a 50-50 chance of getting active drug. And obviously, if you have 0% chance of getting placebo, you would think that that would be more effective than, say, a 75% chance. But that doubt seems to have a little bit of a boost in the efficacy of placebos.
Harvard molecular biologist Catherine Hall is our guide to placebos this hour. Have you had a benefit from taking a placebo? What did your physician say to you about the drug? How did it feel to take that pill? Do you find that your meds give you trust and hope in prolonging your life and giving you a better quality of life? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Catherine Hall here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking closer at the placebo effect here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The role of the placebo is to provide a baseline with which to compare the treatment group, the group that gets the real drug. But in some areas of research, double-blind placebo control studies are not always ethical. Like in cancer care, it's unethical to do placebo control unless there is no other treatment available, so you test against the current standard of care. What do you want to know about placebos? Have you been offered a placebo by your physician? How did you respond? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Catherine Hall with us. She directs the placebo genetics program as part of Harvard's placebo studies, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Saul is joining us from Stevens Point with a question. Hi, Saul.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Fascinating topic. I just read the article in this week's New England Journal of Medicine on placebos and nocebos. And I'm wondering, how do you control for a placebo? If your study is about placebos, what's your control?
Great question, Saul. Thanks. Catherine?
Yes. What we do is we include a no treatment control, which is otherwise known as a standard of care. So the patient gets randomized, or the participant gets randomized, to not receive the sham version of the intervention, but just to continue as they were, whether they're on, you know, a background medicine or not, just continue with whatever they've been getting.
Saul, does that make sense?
No. The second question is, the nocebo effect and the placebo effect both have to do with the patient's mental state. What do they think is going to happen, and how does a physician in any study, when they're giving a placebo or a drug, how do they introduce that to the patient? You might have an effect from this, or they say nothing. Here's medication. We're not going to tell you what it does. Take it.
Oh, so what is that relationship like in the office setting, the clinical setting?
Well, does the patient get any idea about whether this is to help them or harm them?
The information. Yeah, Catherine.
Well, you know, a basic tenet of medicine is to do no harm. And as we, you know, physicians do not give patients treatments that might harm them. However, certainly there are treatments that have side effects, and we have to be as clear as we can with communicating the side effects of drugs. Now, some people might focus on the side effects and may or may not tend to get more side effects that are not necessarily associated with the drug, but associated with the information. And we know this because in clinical trials, oftentimes we see in the placebo arm that patients get the side effects that are expected in the active drug treatment arm. So nocebo effects can be studied in a lab where we might say this cream is not as effective as this cream, and so you might feel more heat or more, you know, experimental pain, and we can study nocebo effects there. But in the real world, nocebo effects are kind of, they just arise out of the honest but negative information around side effects that a patient needs to get as part of regular care. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Catherine, you know, in recent years, has there been an increase in the placebo response in clinical trials? Is it getting harder for drugs to beat the placebo response?
It depends on the drug. So drugs for treating cancer or treating diseases like HIV are doing quite well. The place where we see the placebo response increasing, or it being more difficult to get a drug approved because of the high placebo response relative to the drug response, are more conditions that are what we call functional pain conditions like irritable bowel syndrome or fibromyalgia, and conditions that are psychological or neurological like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and depression or low back pain, conditions where it's working through opioid and dopaminergic signaling.
So really in more of pain management, perhaps, but not, say, lowering your cholesterol or, specifically doing something that would change your body chemistry.
Exactly. Although antidepressants change your body chemistry. However, I think there's a gap between in some of these conditions where we understand what we think is the pathology, not enough serotonin, not enough dopamine, too much dopamine, and the drugs target these pathologies, but there's a gap between how the patient responds and what the drug is doing. And you're right, in conditions like cholesterol lowering, with where you need to have lower cholesterol, like with statins, those drugs work very well. What's interesting there is they some of the statins, for instance, have side effects, but we see those side effects in the placebo arm as well.
We're talking with Catherine Hall. She's a molecular biologist at Harvard Medical School, where she studies how a person's genetic makeup affects their responses to drugs and placebos. You can join in. Do you experience irritable bowel syndrome, fibromyalgia, chronic pain, another syndrome? What do you do to find relief? Do you find relief in traditional medications like antidepressants or painkillers, or have non-conventional therapies helped you? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Catherine, placebos have been found to work in surgeries. In the surgical setting, doctors will actually open up patients and then sew them back up. Can you tell us what's going on there?
We're trying to figure that out. Certainly what we see is that there's a large placebo response in the sham surgery, and the sham surgery is a fake surgery or the placebo surgery. And some of these stories are quite remarkable, whether it's a surgery for renal denervation to control hypertension or rotator cuff surgery. We see that there are these remarkable effects in the sham surgeries.
So the patient goes into surgery, an incision is made. They perhaps go in and scope the shoulder and then close the patient back up?
Yes, yes. And yeah, they have remarkable recoveries. And this has been going on for quite a long time. It's not just, you know, in recent times. There are several surgeries that were done early on that were found to have remarkable effects until they tested them in against a sham surgery and found that they were no better than the sham surgery.
Is that a reflection that we've always thought surgeries make us better regardless?
Well, surgery is thought of as being one of the strongest placebos because it's going into a physician's office or going into a surgical suite, you know, being put under and waking up in pain, sometimes with a scar, is very compelling. And it sends a different message to you. It sends a message that you've taken very dramatic care of your problem and might lead you to reinterpret your symptoms more positively. We don't fully understand what's happening here, but it's very compelling. And I think the key thing here is that we don't replace regular surgeries with sham surgeries. But when oftentimes, if a surgery can't beat a sham surgery, that procedure is called into question. But without replacing it with something else, it's hard to make a change.
Let's take another call now. Dave is joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Absolutely wonderful topic. Your guests are phenomenal. Love the show. I'm a homeopathic and non-Western healer, meaning I use all non-Western healing techniques, no math, no science, etc. And we do surgeries daily here on the north side of Milwaukee. We do a whole host of reproductive surgeries, etc. And I just want to say that Western medicine, when it started on this arc toward using math, using science, using the scientific method, all of this, it abandoned the true, our truth, and the truth I have, my truth, which is My surgeries are done. We have no white people in the room. We have no people who identify as Caucasoid in the room.
So Dave, it sounds like you're doing alternative therapies here. And Catherine, you know, studies of the placebo effect take place in clinical settings, in hospitals, in doctors' offices. What are some of the environmental factors going on?
Well, I think it's basically what cues you're conditioned to and what you find compelling. So the white coat, the stethoscope, the physician or the clinician interacting with you, touch is a very important component of the placebo response. Eye contact, thoughtful silence, reflection, communicating that you're heard and that the clinician really understands and has an intention to take care of you are all really important aspects of the that can induce a placebo response. And we certainly see these in non-traditional settings as well.
Talking with Catherine Hall about the placebo effect, she's with Harvard Medical School, where she researches how a person's genetic makeup affects their responses to drugs and placebos. Physicians, do you employ the placebo effect with your patients? Do you let patients know you're confident they'll get better, or let them know you think a drug will really help them? Do you think your demeanor and your outward expression toward a treatment is connected to outcomes in the patient? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation about placebos with Catherine Hall right after this news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring placebo responses. Placebos are substances that have no actual pharmaceutical effect, and now researchers are looking into whether they could be used as an alternative to traditional pain meds. For instance, the placebo response in clinical trials for rheumatoid arthritis appears to have grown over the last couple decades, with patients feeling less pain after taking a placebo. Do you suffer from chronic pain? Are you considering taking a placebo? Have you discussed this with your physician? What do you say about placebos? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Catherine Hall is a researcher in the placebo studies program at Harvard Medical School, focused on placebo genetics, and she stays with us. Catherine, researchers with you, they've found that placebos work even when study participants are told that the drug they're receiving is just a placebo. Can you tell us more about that research?
Yeah, it doesn't work for every condition. It works in some conditions like lower back pain. And basically what we do is we tell the patient that they might get a placebo, and that placebos work in some people. So it's basically an attempt to present the data on placebos in clinical trials and to leave it to the patient to see if they benefit from a placebo treatment or not. It's not used for everything, and it's still in very early stage in the experimental stages. But we've had very striking results in irritable bowel syndrome, lower back pain, and mostly functional conditions.
Along the way here in taking the drugs, are you doing brain scans throughout the process in these trials?
In not so much an open label placebo as yet, but in many studies, experimental studies, especially in pain, depression, we do brain scans of people in the process of taking placebos to observe changes in their brain in response to the placebo treatment.
And so if they say something on the pain scale and it's lower on the pain scale, you can actually then perhaps match what they're saying to what is happening in the brain chemically and what you're seeing on those scans?
Yeah, there's definitely a consistent set of regions in the brain that are activated in response to taking a placebo treatment. And they are your usual suspects, your prefrontal cortex, regions in your prefrontal cortex that have to do with cognition, reward salience. So like the processing of the information that you're getting a reward. They also have to do with modifying pain, areas like the periaqueductal gray, and in some cases in depression, the amygdala.
Expectations can be powerful in a doctor's office. We know about the white coat syndrome, if you will, elevated blood pressure. Could it be that patients expect placebos to work, that expect taking a pill, any pill, can work?
Expectations have been a really fascinating area to study. It certainly does look as if the greater your expectation of benefit, the greater your relief. In some studies. And as always, there's variability across studies and across conditions and across individuals. But certainly, what we're seeing is that there is an association in changes in your brain with expectations. So in some studies, the greater your expectation, the greater the changes in your brain activity, and the greater your response to the placebo treatment.
But what if you're just a more positive person all around and you would go in the clinical setting with an optimistic attitude that I'm going to get better here. I'm going to be good, feeling better after I do some type of treatment.
In some studies, they have studied the personality differences, and it's called a 5-factor personality measure. So and they have seen that openness and extroversion in some studies in irritable bowel syndrome, for instance, have been associated with better outcomes. These studies are not always consistent as well. And so in other trials, you don't see this association. So it's hard to say, but certainly personality is associated with some of the same changes or I should say neurotransmitters like dopamine and opioids that we see having an effect in placebos.
You've brought up irritable bowel syndrome a couple times now in our conversation. What are you seeing there exactly? What do your numbers show?
There's about a 42% response to placebo in clinical trials of irritable bowel syndrome. And it's not that people's irritable bowel syndrome goes away or is healed or cured. But in the context of clinical trials, there's a very strong placebo response, which makes it really hard to develop new drugs for IBS. There are some great new drugs for IBS constipation, but not so much for IBS diarrhea. And so this high placebo response in IBS makes it a challenge, but it also makes it an opportunity, and why we've done several studies now looking at open label placebos and other types of placebos in IBS to understand really what's going on here.
I wonder what drug companies then think. If they can't beat the placebo, do they continue pushing to find a medication that may work to treat a particular condition?
It's tough. I mean, it's hard to invest literally millions and sometimes billions of dollars in a drug and find out at the end that you can't beat the placebo response. And I think what's really important here is that many drugs have been demonstrated to be safe and have a really like clear mechanism of action. They target a certain pathway, they target the pathology. And so they actually do make changes in the patient's biochemistry, biochemical milieu that should make them better. The problem is that the placebo also makes them better in the clinical trial. And it's really hard for the FDA to justify giving a drug that's no better than the placebo.
I'm curious. Go ahead.
Just to your point, it makes it really hard for pharmaceutical companies to keep, you know, going down that road, because with the placebo response seemingly increasing, it's harder and harder to make a drug that you can actually get through the FDA process. And so, yes, several companies have either folded or they've shut down divisions that work on these kinds of functional conditions that have high placebo response.
Catherine, this is just a real practical question here, but do placebo drugs all look alike, or do they take different forms and different compositions?
Placebos are designed to match the intervention. So in terms of how they look in a clinical trial, if you're giving, you know, red and white capsules, they'll look like a red and white capsule. A white pill, they will look like a white pill. If you're giving an injection, there'll be a sham injection, which has everything in that injection except the active treatment. In a surgery, as we discussed earlier, there'll be an incision. There'll be all the trappings of the surgery except the active intervention. Even in, for instance, in the shoulder surgery, there'll be an arthroscopic maneuver, but there won't be any kind of debriding or treating of the actual wound or offending joint, if you will.
We're talking. Go ahead, Catherine. Yeah.
I was just going to say what's in them really depends on what your, again, what your active treatment is. It could be lactate, cellulose. It's, you know, basically some inert powder.
We're talking with Catherine Hall. She's our guide to placebos. She's at Harvard Medical School, where she studies how a person's genetic makeup affects their responses to drugs. Are you an athlete? Do you have certain things you do before a performance that you know logically won't actually help you do better, but make you feel like you'll perform better? Join in with your thoughts there, 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Catherine, you study how genetics affect our response to drugs and to placebos. Whether someone responds to a placebo is based on genetics. Can you tell us more about that intersection there?
We were interested in looking at some of the genes that regulate the opioid and dopamine signaling pathways in the brain to see if variations in those genes could also change people's response to placebo. And what we found was in some studies in IBS and in again, the functional conditions that are associated with dopamine or opioid signaling, we do see that genes that code, for instance, for higher or lower amounts of dopamine or opioid signaling can modify people's placebo response. What's been really fascinating is that in the placebo arm, we'll see one effect, and that effect will be the opposite in the drug treatment arm, as if the drug might be acting on the placebo response pathway or affecting the natural history of the disease in such a way that there's a different outcome in the drug treatment arm compared to the placebo treatment arm.
Oh, goodness. Now there are a gazillion things to control for.
There are. They've always been. We just haven't been controlling for them.
What are the biggest questions right now about how a person's genetic makeup might change their placebo response and change how we think about placebos in the future?
Well, you might think that it would be nice to just have a genetic signature that you could look at and say, this person is a placebo responder, or this person is not a placebo responder. But it's likely that, obviously, it's more complicated than that. It's probably many genes, not just one gene. And it probably is also environmentally specific and also specific to a certain disease. So, for instance, in one disease, you might want to have high dopamine, whereas in another disease, you might want to have low dopamine. And so a gene that might modify your dopaminergic signals so that you have more dopamine and more dopaminergic activity, that genetic signature might work completely opposite in another condition. And so that's one question. And the other question is, well, how does the environment change that? So for instance, if you are somebody who is, you know, might be a placebo responder, but you then have this amazing experience or amazingly negative experience with a physician, is that going to change your placebo response? And then finally, the questions are, you know, like how stable is this trait? How can we control it? Can we use it to our benefit? And then finally, like, how do drugs modify it? Do all drugs modify it? Do some drugs modify it? and what are the implications for clinical trials?
Are there better options out there for studying the efficacy of drugs besides using a placebo, or is that the gold standard?
Placebos are the gold standard, and I think it's really important to remember that when we're looking at drugs in clinical trials, we're trying to assess not only do they work, but are they safe? And so having a placebo control is a really great way to say, oh, wow, in this portion of the population that received the drug, we saw more of this side effect. That's really important. We don't really have a good substitute in conditions where you really need a, you have a high placebo response and there's no other treatment. We don't really have another alternative. Certainly there are conditions where there are good drugs, and so it's unethical to necessarily randomize somebody to a placebo. You want to compare the novel drug to an already approved drug. And those are called non-inferiority trials. And then in cancer, it's very unethical to give somebody a placebo because it's thought to have no effect at all. And so there's no reason to use it in clinical trials. So those are basically the types of trials that we're doing. There are some very sophisticated models now where they basically either start the trial and then if you're responding to drug or placebo, switch you to the other arm.
We have to we have to pause right there. Catherine Hall here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The placebo effect can be powerful when you respond to a placebo, even though it delivers no actual medicine to you. And it's possible that one day genetic tests may be able to predict which patients would benefit from a placebo treatment. We're exploring what happens when researchers find that a group knowingly taking a placebo reports an improvement in their condition, like less pain or feeling less depressed. Have you taken a placebo? What questions still linger about what they can do to combat symptoms in certain ailments? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Molecular biologist Catherine Hall is with the Placebo Studies Program at Harvard, researching placebo genetics, and she stays with us. Catherine, you were talking there about when it is unethical to use placebos. Can you tell us more about how they can be misused?
Well, the reason why we have clinical trials now is essentially because they were misused early on. So they're really wonderful stories about people, often called quacks, who had all these different types of treatments, whether they were Franz Mesmer, who would mesmerize people with his animal magnetism, or Benjamin Perkins, who had these metallic tractors that he would wave over people, and they would have amazing responses. So I think because this effect is so powerful, people have throughout time used it by selling and promoting what is essentially an inert treatment, but that has amazing effects. And so it's very easy to take advantage of the placebo response. And I think that's why the FDA stepped in and said, you have to demonstrate efficacy beyond the placebo response in order to sell a drug or a treatment.
Is it possible to give a placebo to yourself or provoke the placebo effect in yourself?
That's a really great question. And I actually don't know. I don't know of a study where certainly in some trials, you get mailed a pill pack and you're told what kind of regimen you're to use to take it. And you could be randomized to drug or placebo. So you are kind of giving yourself the pill. But you're saying, like, you get up one morning, you're feeling your knees in pain, and you're going to go and you're going to buy some placebos and take them. I don't think we've done a study on that. And it would be hard to do because you would have to enroll somebody in a study and then they would be kind of not necessarily taking it on their own. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it would be kind of an N of one study.
Right, right. But therapeutic treatments we do for ourselves at home, say someone does meditation or takes CBD oil or does a yoga practice, taking care and time for themselves, saying this is going to help me feel better because of this certain X ailment. Is there any placebo effect going on there?
I think the placebo effect is always going on. It's going on not just in, even in the context of medicine, it's going on in the context of how we respond to our environment, whether it's positive or negative, how we believe and how we interpret the information that's coming in. When it comes to interpretation information about our body, I think that's where you get the placebo effect. You can kind of have a positive or negative perception of how your body is feeling. And you make a good point. Certainly, some of the things that we buy in that, you know, like that nutrient supplement aisle at your health food store may or may not have efficacy, but for us, it might be very effective. And so I think that would be hard to study, but it certainly has to be true that not everything works for everybody, but some things work for some people and maybe not because of their pharmacological activity.
In the last seconds we have with you, Catherine, what does the placebo effect hold in the future? Where are researchers, what are they trying to crack right now with placebos?
We're trying to understand exactly what is happening in the brain and how can we manage it and leverage it to help patients feel better in an age when it's hard to make drugs because it's hard to beat the placebo response. Can we transcend that and can we get people treatments that are effective and safe, whether or not they involve using placebos or not?
Catherine, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Catherine Hall is an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the director of placebo genetics at the program in placebo studies at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. A Canadian energy firm is exploring alternate routes for an oil pipeline that runs through northern Wisconsin. And last summer, the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa filed a lawsuit against Enbridge aimed at shutting down and removing the pipeline from the tribe's reservation. Enbridge is exploring two possible routes, and some communities are divided over the path it may take. Danielle Kading has more.
I'll just walk you over here.
Snow is lightly falling on a January afternoon while Jan Penn trudges through deep snow by Billy Creek on her land in Ashland County. She's found young fish in the Class 1 trout stream that empties into the Marengo River, which drains into the Bad River watershed. The watershed is home to sturgeon and trout and some of the most high-quality wetlands in the Great Lakes. It's part of the reason she and her husband rejected Enbridge's request to survey their land for a roughly 40-mile reroute of Line 5 running south of the Bad River Reservation through Ashland and Iron Counties.
This is just a very unique place with some of the cleanest water in the world.
Penn wants to preserve that and her land, but others see the value their property may bring to struggling communities.
I'm the one who went to Enbridge and said, I need money, I'll help you.
That's Mellon Mayor Joe Barabee heading into an Ashland County board meeting. He was eager to work with Enbridge. The city reached a deal to sell land north of Mellon for $1 million as part of rerouting Line 5. If the pipeline is built, Mellon would receive another $3 million. But because the land in question was designated for public use, the sale depended on approval of the county board. Barabee was there to make the case for the sale. He said the deal is the city's only chance to get out of debt from costly wastewater upgrades. He says they're also facing an expensive road project that will include improving water and sewer lines below.
Half of Mellon is fixed income. Those people won't even afford water when we're done with them.
Mellon's deal also benefits Ashland County, which would get $500,000 from the sale. Without the board's approval, Enbridge said the company would be forced to pursue another route south of Mellon, and the city and county would lose out on the money. Mellon resident Peter Jokinen has a family of six and says his water bills have gone up from $75 to almost $400.
It's ridiculous. This saves us.
Ashland resident Ted Griggs pointed to the company's environmental track record.
It didn't work perfectly in Kalamazoo.
Enbridge spent $1.2 billion cleaning up Michigan's Kalamazoo River after one of its pipelines burst there in 2010. Bad River officials urged the county to hold off on the vote and think of what the reroute would mean for the watershed. Tribal chairman Mike Wiggins told the board everyone is being played by Enbridge.
The other scam that's in play here is that we actually have a choice. It's either the southern route or the northern route. No, they're in the watershed. and they've been asked to leave.
But the board allowed the sale to move ahead. Enbridge spokeswoman Jennifer Smith says that's a key factor in which route they'll choose.
Very soon we do plan to announce a route that we're going to be taking, and we'll start that permitting application.
That process begins with the Public Service Commission. But state regulators won't have a say on the company's proposed route. Matt Sweeney is a PSC spokesman.
The commission only has jurisdiction in cases where somebody wants to use eminent domain to acquire land to build that pipeline. So in those cases, the PSC has to find that the acquisition is in the public interest.
Sweeney says that's unlike the commission's review of natural gas pipelines. It's also unlike surrounding states. A 2015 report by a Michigan task force found Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois all have the authority to determine where pipelines can or can't go in their states. For Jan Penn, there's no route that would protect water from a potential spill.
We don't know where this is going to go, but we're not going to give in easy.
Enbridge has offered Bad River a $24 million settlement to keep the line in place, but the tribe has made no indication it intends to drop its fight to shut down the pipeline across its reservation. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Kind of be reminded, like, we're telling a story about a real person here. A real person whose fate was refashioned once upon a time.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.